Down the length of the train, the lights were going out when Commander Vimes reappeared from his latest sortie and headed for the coffee. "The King and his Council of War are making their plans," he said. "Your latest Clax reports and what I hear from, let's call them, observers on the ground, suggest that work on the rails is going ahead reasonably happily." He looked slyly at Moist. "Pretty soon, it seems, Mr. Litvig, you'll have to put your money where your mouth is. Oh, and another thing. Here's a flimsy from your good wife. Even with the news of the Schmalzberg coup spreading, there appear to have been very few attacks on the Clax towers outside Überwald." Taken aback, Moist said, "Well, that is good news." But Vimes just frowned and said, "Don't get excited. I'd wager that there are still some out there who'd knock over a Clax tower even if they saw tack on the top of it. That's the trouble, you see. When you've had hatred on your tongue for such a long time, you don't know how to spit it out." Moist had made sure, oh bliss, right from the start, that he would have a sleeping compartment of his own. But, unlike those in the first-class sleeper carriage, his was more utilitarian, and using it was an exercise suited to people who like toying with twisty cubes and other notorious playthings. It had a folding bed, which folded down and hit him on the head, and a wash basin into which his toothbrush would just about fit. But there was a sponge provided, and since he was suitably athletic, he made the best of it, ending up, if not clean, not any dirtier either. And gods, he was tired, and whatever it was that drove him seriously needed a rest. But the mind was its own worst enemy, and the more he tried to get himself lulled by the rhythms of the railway, the more his niggling thoughts seemed to burgeon like a cloud. They had been lucky so far, only the two Grag spies to deal with, and pretty poor spies at that. But sooner or later, the rat would surely be out of the bag and the Grags would know that Rhys was on board. Simnel's hope seemed to rest on the fact that they would be using Iron Girder by that time. But could she really make a difference? Simnel's little experiment, more used to giving children rides around the yard. I'm sure that when that locomotive of Simnel's first arrived, Moist thought, it was pretty small, and I wondered how it could go the distance even to Stow Lat. But now she seems so powerful. And the way Simnel keeps upgrading her and paying her attention. It's as if something bad would happen if she wasn't the queen of the yard. She never sleeps. There's always that little hiss, that little tinkle of metal, mechanical susurration, whether or not she is ostensibly running. Moist thought about whoever it was who had got into the compound to smash her up, who ended up dead, dead, dead. Wild steam from a train that wasn't running. Earth, fire, wind and rain all in one element of speed. And slowly, Moist shut down, although a part of him was always listening to the rhythm of the rails, listening in his sleep, like a sailor listening to the sounds of the sea. As Moist slept, the train barreled like a very slow meteor through the night, climbing up through the Karak Mountains. Almost the only light to be seen with the moon under a cloud came from the engine's headlamp and the glow from the furnace when the door was opened to shovel in more coal. The engine stokers of the hygienic railway were a breed apart, taciturn, perennially grumpy, seemingly only willing to talk to the drivers. In the unwritten hierarchy of the footplate, the drivers were at the top, of course, and then the stokers, and after the stokers there would be the wheel tappers and shunters. Lesser beings, but acknowledged as useful. At times it appeared that the stokers considered themselves the most important component of the railway, keepers of its soul, as it were. When off duty, they all messed together, grumbling, puffing their wretched pipes, and talking to nobody else. But shovelling coal all day built muscles of iron, so the stokers were strong and fit. And sometimes, between shifts, there were sparring matches with shovels, with the combatants cheered on by their fellows. In fact, one of the stokers on the train was a bit of a legend, according to the others, although Moist had not come across him yet. Stoker Blake was said to be death on legs if he was aroused. The other stokers were fierce fighters, but it was claimed that none of them ever got to touch Stoker Blake. A stoker's shovel, incorrectly used, was an illustration of Commander Vimes's dictum that a workman's tool, used cunningly, could give the average watchman a real headache. And so the stokers laughed and danced as they sparred with their shovels and got drunk. But not when they were going to be on the footplate. They didn't need telling about that. Tonight, cocooned from the cool wind that flew around the cab, Stoker Jim said to the train driver, "Here's your coffee, Mick. Fancy a fry-up?" Mick nodded without taking his eyes off the track ahead, and so Stoker Jim carefully reached out and fried a couple of eggs on the back of his shovel, courtesy of the fiery furnace. The houses, hastily built for the railway workers, were close to the water cranes and coal bunkers, so that an eye could be kept on the precious coal and water supplies. They were quite small, which put some strain on the accommodation when there were children and grandparents as well, but everyone said that it was twice as good as what might be found in the big city, and after all, you were out in the fresh air, at least in between locomotives. On this night, Mrs. Plumridge, mother of Jack Plumridge the linesman, realised that her chamber pot was overflowing, and cussed herself for not emptying it before twilight. She didn't trust the gleaming porcelain and the ablutions. All her life she had gone outside to a designated private spot in the garden, taking care to remember which of her little plots to empty it in this time, and therefore things got rather receptacle-shaped when a dwarf jumped out in front of her, screamed, "Death to the railway!" and tried to throw something at her. In response, Mrs. Plumridge hefted the chamber pot with a strength you might not have expected from such an old woman, who, according to her son, was made out of teak. The pot was very large and remained regrettably very full, and the scream woke up all the households nearby. And when the miscreant Delver came back to consciousness, he was tied up and en route to Ankh-Morpork for judgment. The railway men and their grannies were no-nonsense people. Earthy, you might say, and they didn't even allow the Delver to wash himself, and that was a terrible thing in the circumstances. When Moist awoke the following morning, he realised that he was hungry and was pleased to discover that there was breakfast, all-day breakfast as it turned out, in the dining carriage. He found the dining car empty but for Bashful Bashfulson and the Low King, sitting chatting like businessmen with a deal to make, taking advantage of the cornucopia. Quietly, the King welcomed him and said, "Not seen much of the train so far, Mr. Litvig. Been in a planning session with Bashfulson and the others since we boarded. Will you join us?" As Moist sat down, Bashfulson turned to him as if to an ally. "I'm trying to get Rhys here to tell us what he's up to." The King merely smiled at this. "I intend to take Schmalzberg with you, my friend Bashfulson, and do it with as little bloodshed as possible. Believe me, although it's vexing to remember it, I am the king of my enemies as well as my friends. There's a certain noblesse oblige, see? It's a bad king who kills his subjects. I would rather see them humiliated than dead." Bashfulson said, "Really? After all the things they've done, and the things they've caused to be done, finding young dwarfs and filling them with excitement and idiotic revelations?" "I have names," said the king. "Names of leaders, names of hangers-on. Oh yes, there will be a reckoning. Not an auto-da-fe." "I fear you were too understanding with them last time, sire," Bashfulson said, picking his words carefully. "Sad to say, but I've come to the conclusion that if you keep turning the other cheek, they'll go on slapping you in the face. I think there's nothing for it but to go in, cut out, and have done. No point in knocking politely this time, saying, 'Can I have the scone of stone back, please?'" To Moist's surprise, the king said, "However much we disdain the word politics, one of its most useful aspects is the stopping of bloodshed. Oh yes, bloodshed there will be, but the generations stream away and people change and things thought of as totally impossible suddenly turn out to be every day, nay essential. Just like the railway is becoming, see? Apropos of that, Mr. Litvig, how is the railway progressing? How are your loggy sticks going?" "Copacetic, sire. That's an engineer term meaning all satisfactory." The king gave Moist a look. It wasn't by the standard of looks a nasty one, but it was, after all, a king's look, and the gaze of the king was subtly quizzical and testing. "We shall see, boyo. We shall see." And after breakfast there was nothing for it but to watch the mountain scenery flow past as if on some endless winding belt. Trees, rocks, more trees, bigger rocks. Trees again, what was possibly a clearing where lumbermen were working, brief darkness as they reached a rock big enough to require a tunnel, and so on. And yet, Moist thought, behind all those trees and all those rocks and crags, there are homesteads and small villages that we don't know about, and so one day we'll have to have a stop here, here, and here. And then one day, some kid from the settlement, high up in that last lot of rocks, will catch the train and end up in Ankh-Morpork. Full of hope, and why not? Station by station, we are changing the world. And he allowed himself a little glow of pride. Apart from the falls, Moist had seen the falls before, and that's just what they were. Falls. Pretty good falls by the standard of falls, but once you'd looked at them for a few minutes, undoubtedly someone would say, "Where can we get a coffee round here?" Apart from the falls, the only place that was any significance in Zemphis was Downsized Abbey. It was a ruin now, the monks long gone. These days it was more of a souk, a medina, a heaving bazaar which reminded Moist of the shades of Ankh Morpork on their holidays. Nothing was still, silence was a rare blessing, and everyone was a trader, and it seemed that sooner or later everything and everyone could be bought and sold, and, if necessary, disappeared. Of the trading routes in Zemphis, the Aglet's Road stood out, as caravans of camels arrived on their way to bring the people of the plains the tiny little things on the ends of their shoelaces, without which civilized life would be unbearable and quite dangerous. There were spices from Klatch, and, if you knew where to ask, the fabled Klatchian migratory bog truffle, which, despite resembling the Klatchian bog toad in both taste and appearance, was extremely rare and therefore a delicacy. Materials from the counterweight continent, which had arrived by slow barge, other mysterious delicacies, and unfortunately many ways to become very happy in a short space of time and stone dead shortly afterwards. Alongside the legitimate goods traded at the front of the stalls, without doubt there was some contraband, as many traders luxuriated in the semi-lawless landscape. Cages of undomesticated imps were available in the back rooms of some more unscrupulous shops, and after dark the occasional camel slipped in or out of the town carrying barrels of crude treacle. And even though most sensible people wishing to hang on to their personal possessions, or indeed their lives, would follow the advice of those who had been there and give it a wide berth, some possibly foolhardy tourists did come to Zemphis on their way to see the Paps of Scylla, a jagged mountain range which allowed the determined mountaineer an absolute smorgasbord of ways to be found upside down above a crevasse and hanging by one leg over white water that acted like the mother of all grinders. There were 8 peaks in all, sharp and unforgiving, and if there were such a thing as the good ambushing guide, it would be right up there with the winners. Contemplating the Paps from a seat conveniently placed by the burghers of Zemphis as a lookout point for those admiring the view, Moist reflected that shortly their train would have to travel through those peaks. They didn't look so bad on the map, but up close and personal they were awesome. Scylla must have been very proud 8 times over. A mist hung over the greenery clinging to the steep foothills of the Paps. The terrain looked impassable for a train, but Simnel's sliding rule boys had found a suitable way through. Track had been laid, and Moist knew that they'd had trolls hanging around there all week keeping guard. Just then, there was a shout from Commander Vimes, "Litvig, drop!" Moist dropped, while whatever the commander had seen scythed overhead, and he was just picking himself up when Vimes tackled him back down to the ground as the missile whistled round for another slice before finally dropping somewhere near their feet. "And there you have it," said Vimes. "Really nasty fellows, delvers, but you've got to admire their workmanship." Moist, still at ground level, said as if it mattered, "Was it really them?" "Quite likely, but there are other nuisances in these hills. You must know that where there are tourists, there are also people eager for their dollars. Don't touch it." Moist's hand flew back. "It's a boomerang," said Vimes. "You find something like this all over the world. You have to wave it carefully and suddenly your opponent gets it in the back. I've heard there's a lad in Forex who can throw a boomerang with such precision that it can get the morning paper and come back with it." Moist gave the commander a look of disbelief. "Well, that's what they say. And you know those boys from Forex, they love to draw a long bow." Vimes continued, picking up the boomerang gingerly with a handkerchief. He sniffed it, grimaced and said, "The stuff the Grags have put on this one might not kill you, but you'll wish that it had for a day or two, if you're lucky. I'm going to have to talk to Veterinari about this place. They've got something like a government here, but their policing might just be adequate in a kindergarten. They're not exactly bent, just not organised in the right way. Good grief, I could even send Nobby up here and the quality of the policing would go comparatively sky high. Surely Veterinari's remit doesn't stretch all the way out here, and you're well out of your jurisdiction, aren't you? To Moist's amazement, Vimes laughed and said, I couldn't speak for Veterinari, but we all know he has his ways and his means. I think he allows this place to exist so that it doesn't exist in Ankh-Morpork. As for my jurisdiction, I wouldn't be surprised if there are a number of people in this place who'd like to see some law in the streets. So if that were the case, well, it might be my duty to assist. But not today. He patted Moist on the shoulder and said, Mr. Litbig, I'm sure there have been times in your life when you've seen a wonderful opportunity to steal something valuable and you've decided for various reasons not to. Well, I feel as you would then. This place is a sink. Who knows what dreadful things are happening behind closed doors? He shrugged and went on. But you can't kick down every door in the universe, and we have more pressing matters to attend to. Moist accepted this sad explanation, and after a fruitless hunt around for their assailants, they turned their backs on the Paps to head back to the station. As they left the lookout point, they heard a train whistle in the distance. Far away, climbing into Zemphis on the main line from the plains, there was a streak of scintillating sunlight with a trail of steam. Vimes looked at Moist and said, What the hell is that? There isn't another train due today, is there? Well, Dick said he was polishing up Iron Girder for the big event, and before we left he was talking as if his favourite locomotive had been getting a complete overhaul. That must be her. In fact, it wasn't just an overhaul. When Moist had shown Simnel the micromail he had received as spoils of the battle with the dwarfs at the Quirm Railhead, the young engineer had smiled and said, Aye, I know what the secret is here. This is a metal stronger than iron, malleable and half its weight, and it never rusts. Its ore is rare, but it's the base of a new alloy I've made. I call it Sorotanium, which Mr. Thunderbolt says means the sister of iron. It's stronger even than steel. What boilers I could make with it, if only I could get hold of enough of the stuff. Thank you. It's amazing, and I know just what to do with it. As they watched the astonishing locomotive dealing with the steep haul into Zemphis, Moist noticed that the engine appeared to shrug off the load behind her. The flyer they had come in on earlier had been creaking as it chugged up the last steep haul into Zemphis. This new train didn't even seem to notice the gradient. Vimes smacked his head and said, Is that really Iron Girder? Last I saw of Iron Girder, she was providing a playground entertainment for grown-ups. If that's Iron Girder, he said, pointing at the shimmering apparition, surely she's grown. It is Iron Girder, said Moist. Dick spends all his time tinkering with her, over and over again, improving her at every turn and opportunity. And at the end, well, she's still Iron Girder. She'll always be Iron Girder. But she's so easily spotted, all that shining. People are going to see her coming for miles. No chance of an inconspicuous departure, then. I know, said Moist. But since you can hear her coming for miles, Dick said it won't make any difference. Everyone will know we're coming. Though the silver carapace, in fact, could make a significant difference in other ways, he thought. If you please, Agragnan, a dwarfish translation, my lord. We have lost track of our two agents on one of the trains, said the acolyte. Alas, we are no longer in touch with them. The Grag commander looked up. Aha, he said. Where were they when we last heard from them? On the regular service from Stolat to Zemphis, but they failed to report at Big Cabbage or earlier as the train passed through Cranberry.
Are you certain?
The acolyte jumped.
Well, my lord, we are in the dark, but I think so.
In that case, said the Grag, make it known that we are no longer bothering with the other routes. Our package must have been on that train to Zemphis, and from there the Paps await, and they take no prisoners. They, my friend, are coming to us, and the creatures that live in the Paps will be our allies. It's all about the railway now. And we know that it is in the compass of our agents to stop those blasted wheels turning. Be mindful of bridges, however. The enemy favours the dreadful stone people who love to guard them. And surely tunnels can also be made to fail. This wretched technology contains the seeds of fallibility.
Yes, Gregnan, we know that the locomotive has to stop frequently for coal and water. Deprive it of either, and there is no locomotive, just a lamp of old iron. So, the coal bunkers, and yes, water cranes. There will be guards, of course, but they should be easy to overcome when stationary.
The Chief Grag returned to his study of the words of Tack, as annotated by Grag Hamcrusher.
Let me know when the deed is done.
Down at the Zemphis terminus, Iron Girder looked even more spectacular up close. Dick Simnel was dressed smartly and grinning proudly as he showed off the glittering engine and all the dials and gauges on the footplate. Seeing Dick wearing clothes that had no grease on them was astonishing, like seeing a lion without a mane. Along with cheery Littlebottom and other members of the City Watch who had been summoned by Commander Vimes, Moist was surprised to see the cheerful and homely face of Constable Bluejohn, the largest troll on the force. Bluejohn, whom even Detritus described as a big boy, was by nature as gentle as a breeze and wouldn't hurt a fly, at least not on purpose, although he could quite possibly tear a lion in half with his bare hands if needed. Nevertheless, the sight of him on the scene of any fracas was an invitation to run a marathon in the other direction rather than face the megalith. He lived in a reinforced house somewhere in Sunink, a little town inadvisably nestling in the outskirts of Ankh Morpork. They said that the sound of Bluejohn walking to work was better than an alarm clock. Vimes marched off down the platform to greet the new arrivals. Cheery was looking very cheerful as any decoy could be who had been the winner of a battle and had come out more or less unscathed, except for a small scar, which you had to have, didn't you, or no one would believe you. The tour of the footplate finished, Simnel turned to Moist. According to our schedule, we ought to be going. He blew his whistle and shouted down the platform, All aboard! There was no way of avoiding considerable attention as the King's party assembled to board the armoured carriages behind Iron Girder. The engine herself was spectacular, and her passengers were unusual even for a city like Zemphis. There were the dwarfs, the Low King and his bodyguards, Aaron, his secretary, and Bashful Bashfulson. There were suspiciously deep shadows that suggested the continued presence of dark clerks. There were several specialist members of the watch, which didn't include Corporal Nobby Nobbs or Sergeant Colon, who were not precisely special, but, as Moist knew, curiously useful, which was why Vimes put up with them. There were the goblins, who scrambled into the guard's van being coupled on at the rear, and just in front of the van was a flatbed carrying Constable Bluejohn, along with equipment and baggage too bulky for the guard's van. Iron Girder was fully in steam again now, and the vapour surrounded everybody. Vimes went with the engineers as they walked right around the train for a final check. Then came the scream of the whistle and the little shunting dance that Iron Girder did before gaining speed. With someone staring from every carriage window, the special express train to Überwald started to show what it could do. The story told locally about the Paps of Scylla was that they were formed when one huge mountain fell apart, leaving a treacherous network of broken caverns. Some full of water, always overflowing, topped by the 8 forbidding peaks, which seemed to hang in the moisture-laden air surrounded by rainbows. After the boomerang incident in Zemphis, Moist wasn't very keen on seeing the Paps up close and personal, but Simnel's surveyors had excelled themselves. The railway track insinuated itself up through the craggy gaps so that the train climbed majestically higher and higher, leaving the city of Zemphis and the heat shimmer of the Sierra far below. Halfway towards the gloom of the pass between the tallest peaks, the train emerged from a large natural tunnel into another kaleidoscope of rainbows, which were distracting even when people weren't throwing things at your head. Without warning, a boulder smashed down in front of the train and rolled across the tracks to shatter in the opposite gully. Then there was another crash from the rear. The train shuddered horribly and carried on. Moist looked up and saw dwarfs perched on the craggy cliffs on each side of the canyon, levering boulders down onto the train. Commander Vimes could be heard cursing and shouting orders down the carriages. His words drowned out as yet larger boulders fell, raining down on the locomotive, which was moving slowly forward like an old lady testing the water. Surely, Moist thought, this is the end. even if the tracks ahead remain undamaged. No normal engine could withstand this bombardment. But then he realised that Iron Girder, slowly and methodically, was actually steaming on despite the boulders continuing to pound the train. Moist couldn't stop himself. He shouted to anyone who would listen, "They're bouncing off! It's the Sorotanium! It takes the punishment and throws it right back!" Meanwhile, at the rear of the train, Constable Bluejohn, standing on his flatbed, gently rocking with the motion, thundered a troll threat, reached out and plucked a miscreant from his foothold unwisely close to the track. When he was joined by Detritus, the assailants soon discovered that aiming boulders at the trolls was a fool's errand. The lads, who were quite literally in their element, just grabbed them and tossed them back with interest. Looking out of a broken window, Moist saw a small swarm of goblins leave the train, and at first he thought, ha, trust the buggers to run away, and then he mentally corrected himself. That was storybook thinking, and with clearer eyesight and a bit of understanding, he realised that the goblins were scrambling up to the delvers on the rocks and beating the shit out of them by diving into the multiple layers of dwarf clothing. The delvers discovered all too rapidly that trying to fight while a busy goblin was in your underwear was very bad for the concentration. Of the twilight, the darkness suddenly appeared at Moist's elbow. He was wearing a helmet that was far too big for him and spun around on his head. He pushed one arm into the greasy nest he called a jacket and struck a pose.
"Marvellous, ain't they? Always going for the gonads!"
There were screams, sometimes high-pitched, as the delvers lost their hold and fell down either under the train or into the water, still fighting the speedy goblins. As Iron Girder steadfastly steamed on round the next bend, she and her coal tender came into Moist's field of vision, and he was horrified to see a couple of delvers had gained a foothold on the tender. They were being held at bay by a soot-blackened stoker who was valiantly protecting access to the footplate by wielding his shovel to deadly effect. Moist caught a glimpse between the chaos of fighting bodies of the stoker dispatching one of the delvers, kicking him over the side. A massive blow with the shovel dealt with the other dwarf, and the stoker dropped out of sight. His sheer efficiency had been vaguely disturbing. Perhaps that's the legendary Stoker Blake, Moist thought, and then ducked back inside as another boulder crashed past. Finally, the bombardment ceased, and Moist made his way down the train. He found the Low King in one of the armoured carriages with Bashfulson and the rest of his party. There was blood on the King's beard. "The foe is either fleeing or dead," the King said. "The wounded will be taken aboard under lock and key, and undoubtedly the good commander will have them talking to him as if they were the best of friends. He has a knack for that sort of thing."